Radio.
Opposing death with dignity and same-sex marriage, faith or reason. A public lecture by Professor John Finnis for the Centre for Faith, Ethics and Society at the University of Notre Dame, Australia.
Many thanks for that most generous introduction, Aidan. About euthanasia, we're all going to be involved in debate for the rest of our lifetimes. It's going to remain the matter of struggles for power, of repeated efforts of collective deliberation, for as long as we can see ahead. Around the world, there'll be majority decisions by courts, legislatures, electorates, sometimes by wide margins, that will be labelled consensus. But to be free people, free persons and citizens, we need to think of this as what it is, a great issue of moral truth, of judgment and responsibility for ourselves and to others, an issue of rational criteria and of standards by which we, anyone, can critically assess and judge legislatures, bureaucrats, electorates and courts, and all those who call the tune in universities, law schools and the media and so forth. If we're to keep our critical freedom, we can't accept ambiguous and euphemistic slogans such as death with dignity, or declarations that history has decided or is deciding this issue or has settled other issues so that as a matter of principle and integrity, this issue must now be decided in a new way. Conscience judges not by wordplay nor by the play of judicial or any other majoritarian or elite power, opinion, attitude or will, but by looking for reasons. Good as reasons. Much the same is true of the question whether the state, its law and its government, should recognise and ratify marriage between persons of the same sex, and whether such unions are entitled to equality or parity of moral esteem and legal status with unions of a man and a woman united in commitment of the kind that has for millennia been known as marriage. Now, of course, we need to get beyond words, and when we do, we can carry forward our reflections on and discussions of this issue without constant resort to quotation marks, scare quotes, around the word marriage in the phrase same-sex marriage. As everyone knows that, custom or religious or state law can use the word marriage to apply to sexual unions for, say, a fixed term, such as 10 years, or a month, or a weekend, temporary marriages, or to unions revocable at will, such as Shiite Muslim muta marriages, better known to some as contracts of prostitution, and to sexually non-exclusive unions, open marriage, or to sexual unions between three or four or more partners, polygamy, or more commonly polygyny, more generally polyamory, or to marriages between adult and child, such as that prophet's marriage to a six-year-old consummated very few years later, or to sexual unions between persons of the same sex, same-sex marriage. The fact that we can use the term or word or phrase doesn't change what marriage is, what's worthy of the name in a fully reasonable view. And forming such a view is, as with euthanasia, a matter for each of us of serious responsibility. So I'm going to consider each of these great issues in turn, quite independently of religious teachings and beliefs. There are, I shall say, compelling reasons, which I'll just outline, to uphold and maintain the legal rule and moral judgment that excludes from our civil life and from our personal and family life all choices to kill. every choice to do or omit something in order to terminate or shorten life. That is, with that sort of aim or purpose or intention, three words there with the same meaning. And I'm going to argue that there are compelling reasons, especially of justice, to maintain the legal and moral judgment that marriage is a committed and exclusive union between a man and a woman, a union of the kind that by its nature and the nature of the sexual act at its heart is adapted to the generating of offspring of that couple and to the wholesome nurturing of any such offspring of theirs. These same compelling reasons, accessible to everyone, are also reasons that are ratified by the one religion which holds as part of the faith it says is entrusted to it by God, that the moral judgments which anyone of some experience and maturity can reliably reach by the sort of reflection that is called philosophical are also judgments of the very same content as God has confirmed in the special historical events which that religion proclaims, for instance, in this university and not just in its chapel, to be a disclosure, a revelation of the divine intention for the lives and well-being of each and every human person. In the moral domain, then, this religion, this faith, rejects the either-or insinuated in the title I chose for my address this evening. That either-or, faith or reason, was taken over from the popular assumption, the fallacy widespread in media and secular universities and absorbed into the thinking of some religious people and groups in our nation, that if something is a matter of faith, it's not a matter of reason. So if there's anyone here who came expecting me to plump for one or other of the alternatives, say faith rather than reason, or reason rather than faith, this is perhaps the moment to get up and go, because that's not going to happen. For those of you who remain to the end, I shall close with a bit more explanation and amplification of what I just very briefly said about faith and reason, about the place of religious belief and teaching in the public domain of a secular society such as ours. Well then, by euthanasia, I mean, as most people mean, the adopting and carrying out of a proposal that, as part of the medical care being given someone, his or her life shall be terminated here and now, or by means of abbreviation, on the ground that it would be better for him or her, or at least no harm, if that were done. That sort of proposal can be carried out at the request of the person to be put to death, in which case we have voluntary euthanasia, or without such request, which is non-voluntary euthanasia. It could, of course, also be carried out against the wishes of the person concerned, which we might call involuntary, or better, contra-voluntary euthanasia. And in each of these types of case, the proposal might be carried out by acts which work to hasten death, active euthanasia, or by deliberate omission or withholding of life-sustaining means, such as food and water, passive euthanasia. It turns out that none of these distinctions is of fundamental importance to the moral or legal permissibility or impermissibility of euthanasia. Though, of course, it would matter a lot to the degree of wrongness that the euthanizing was contra-voluntary, against the will of the person put to death. But no one nowadays is arguing for that, though many people are using arguments which, at least by implication or entailment, below the surface, would, if valid, justify involuntary as well as voluntary euthanasia, as we'll see. While considering these definitions, let's notice that one form of euthanasia, one way of carrying out a proposal to shorten or terminate life deliberately, is by assisting suicide, usually called a bit ineptly assisted suicide. There, the proposal is shared by the person whose life is to be deliberately ended, and that person is also the one who takes the steps that, of themselves, bring about that intended effect. But another person, going along with sharing the proposal, does something towards carrying it out by lending some assistance, by the providing or readying of equipment or other ways and means. In the United States, and to some extent in this country, I think, debate has to some extent been fixated on assisted suicide, as if it were not a form of euthanasia. But it is. If legalized by itself, it would only be a whistle stop on the way to legalization of much wider subcategories of euthanasia. There's a certain amount of obfuscation involved in highlighting assistance in suicide. Sometimes the train goes right through the whistle stop without stopping, as in the Northern Territory in 1995, where the Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, 1995, was presented to the public, and I suspect to the Legislative Assembly, as all about assistance in killing oneself. Its central provision seemed to mean precisely that. It said, Section 4, a patient who in the course of a terminal illness is experiencing pain, suffering, and or distress to an extent unacceptable to the patient may request the patient's medical practitioner to assist the patient to terminate the patient's life. Unquote. But the Act definition of assist in Section 2 gave, at the very end of a long list, a final item, and the administration of a substance to the patient. So this was all along a wide euthanasia, voluntary euthanasia, law, under colour of a law about assisting suicide. As you all know, it was nullified by the federal legislature in March 1997, after coming into effect in July 1996. The operative provision of the Commonwealth Parliament's Euthanasia Laws Act 1997 nullifies any territorial enactments, Northern Territory, Australian Capital Territory, which permit or have the effect of permitting, whether subject to conditions or not, I'm quoting, the form of intentional killing of another called euthanasia, which includes mercy killing, or the assisting of a person to terminate his or her life. Now notice the decisive role of intention. The 1997 Act goes on to preserve the power of territorial legislatures to make laws, I quote, with respect to A, the withdrawal or withholding of medical or surgical measures for prolonging the life of a patient, but not so as to permit the intentional killing of the patient, and B, medical treatment in the provision of palliative care to a dying patient, but not so as to permit the intentional killing of the patient, unquote. Intentional killing means, of course, killing with an intention, which need not be one's only intention, of bringing about death, of shortening life, by some course of actions or omissions. Intention is a reality, not merely a word. That's why the word is synonymous with many other words and phrases, with the aim of, with the purpose of, trying to, in order to, with a view to, or plain to, as in he came to Notre Dame to listen to a lecture, or she gave the morphine to kill the patient to let the children claim under the expiring insurance policy. You intend your end, your aim, purpose, sought after outcome, and your chosen means. Consequences which you foresee, even as certainties, are not intended unless they are one of the ends or one of the means in the plan, or as I've been calling it, the proposal you adopt by choice and carry out by conduct, whether actions or omissions. We foresee jet lag flying the Indian Ocean, hangover after the party, fading of curtains in bright sunlight, the wearing out of our shoes, the annoyance of people who hear our stuttering, the death of our own troops in the assault we've ordered, the inequalities in results of students if they're tested by examination. We intend none of those consequences, however inevitable. The whole law of murder, which is almost all of our law about euthanasia, turns on the idea of intention. And certainly the ethics of the healthcare professions turns on that idea, which gives little difficulty to careful professionals in distinguishing in their own deliberations and choices between giving a preparation with the intent to relieve pain, with the perhaps fully foreseen side effect, as it may be, of shortening life, but calibrating the dosage just to the relieving of pain, and on the other hand, the radically different kind of choice involved in giving perhaps the very same preparation with perhaps the very same dosage, but calibrated so as to bring about death. To bring about death perhaps as a means to relieve pain, or as a means to relieve the expense of treatment for the relatives, or for the insurers or the public purse, or as a means to enable a relative to claim on a soon expiring insurance policy, and so forth. Both the law and professional ethics turn on this distinction, which is utterly real even in those cases where getting evidence about which of the two kinds of choice is being made is very difficult. For the person making the choice, at the time of deliberation and choice, the distinction is always clear and known, unless they're just stupid or befuddled with drink and the like. And once that firm and bright line, drawn with the idea and reality of intention, is abandoned, and some intentional killing is permitted by professional ethics or by law, there's no other line that can be drawn without more or less ridiculous arbitrariness and fragility. One popular way of trying to draw a new line is with the idea of autonomy and the consequent permission only of voluntary euthanasia. Reformers say everyone has a right to autonomy, the right, as a notorious judgment of the United States Supreme Court put it, the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. But healthy people who demand assistance in suicide or actual euthanasia at the hands of medical personnel will promptly find themselves being told by these same reformers that, well, after all, the right to death with dignity belongs not to those with an autonomy interest in defining their own concept of existence and so forth, but to people whose lives are no longer worth living. And that means whose lives are no longer worth living in the opinion of a court or medical practitioners, in the context of legislative criteria adopted by courts or legislatures from time to time. Even when you fall seriously ill or become clinically depressed, you'll find, if the reformers are to be believed, that your right to autonomy does not give you the right to be assisted in suicide, unless you're ill enough, or suffering enough, or depressed severely and incurably enough, or have a life expectancy abbreviated enough. And in each case, the enough is in the view of somebody else, other people. And this, of course, is no surprise, for what you are proposing is not a private act, but precisely an act in which you seek assistance from someone else, or which you're asking someone else to carry out, sharing your intent to destroy your personal life. It's no more a private act, and in that sense autonomous, than a duel or an agreement to sell oneself into slavery. And so what one might call the bottom line issue becomes clearer. When should we allow some people to sit in judgment on the life of another human person and to judge that person's life worthless or insufficiently worthwhile in its prospects, and so to authorize themselves or others to carry out that person's request for death? And then if such judgments about the insufficient worth of a person's life are decisive, why not also decisive when the judgment about insufficient or negative quality of life is the same, but the request for help to terminate life cannot be made or has not been made? Now one begins to see the doomed fragility of any attempt to draw a new line between the permissible and the impermissible by reference only to voluntariness or autonomy. That is, to draw a bright and sustainable line between voluntary and non-voluntary euthanasia. The issue isn't whether physicians can reasonably make the more limited assessment necessary to judge further treatment futile or too burdensome or not rewarding enough to be worth the costs in suffering, money, labour, or use of other resources. Those are difficult, inherently uncertain judgments, but they are made in any case, routinely, in countless ways, in countless cases. They are judgments that remain focused upon the treatment and the burdens and benefits of that, and fall short of the global assessment of a person's whole existence needed to warrant a decision focused precisely on terminating that existence, to undertake a course of conduct with the intent to kill or assist in the killing of that person, to destroy or assist in the deliberate destruction of his or her very being, so far as is humanly possible. In thinking about the implications of changing the law, we shouldn't do so by looking at the new permission we are envisaging while holding steady and unchanged everything else in the picture. My distinguished late American colleague in Oxford, Ronald Dworkin, gave the British public good advice in 1978. He said, when considering the impact of introducing a Bill of Rights enforceable in the courts, don't for a moment assume that it will be interpreted and enforced by lawyers and judges with today's attitudes. A whole new breed of lawyers and law teachers and judges will rapidly come into existence to give effect to the new regime. And the advice he gave and prediction he made were rapidly verified when later the Human Rights Act 1991 introduced just such a Bill of Rights and transformed British law and politics. So don't think of a euthanasia law being administered by today's medical practitioners and nurses and hospital administrators whose codes of ethics exclude killing as a treatment and management option. If the law of murder were changed in the way proposed, and especially if it were changed by court decision declaring what is every citizen's right as part of the very meaning of liberty or autonomy or privacy or dignity, the ethics of all those professions and classes would be bound to change. Change would in fact be pretty rapid, I think, hastened along by the none too gentle spur of the law of torts. We shouldn't distract ourselves here, or in relation to same-sex marriage for that matter, by the issue of conscience clauses, needed though these would be. The real question is not about the right of the few Orthodox Catholics and Jews and other mavericks to opt out. It's about the bulk of ordinary, decent professionals equipped with new treatment options which would greatly simplify the management of difficult cases by the elimination of the human being causing the trouble. Our doctors have always had the power to kill us and to disguise their deed. Doctors who give painkillers have in quite a few situations the power to decide to terminate life under the guise of deciding what would quell pain and to get away with it. In many cases. In many, many situations, nothing prevents the doctor deciding to kill save an ethic which simply excludes that option, the ethic that insists upon the very same difference as the law of murder between intending to kill and accepting death as a side effect, possibly a welcome side effect, but still unintended, an effect of something done with no such intent. Now change the law and the professional ethic, killing with intent becomes a routine management option. Well, there are restrictions, there are guidelines, there's paperwork, well meant, not utterly irrelevant, but as nothing compared with our doctor's change in heart, professional formation, and conscience. So our doctors would enter our sick rooms as men and women trained to be willing to kill on the occasions of their choosing. Guided, we hope, by new professional and legal standards, which, however, will shift to and fro, searching for the bright line lost with the majoritarian judicial or legislative overthrow of the line between intending to kill and intending to heal, treat, alleviate, palliate, and so forth. A new zone of silence, then. Can I safely speak to my physician about the full extent of my sufferings, about my fears, about my occasional or regular wish to be free from the burdens? Will my words be heard as a plea to be killed, as a tacit permission? And why does my physician need my permission, my request? The Dutch guidelines, insisted upon in court pronouncements and later in legislation and described in the Dutch press and literature with robotic mantra-like regularity as strict and precise, demand that euthanasia be preceded by an explicit request. But within 5 years, most Dutch medical killings were without any explicit request whatever. And though the reporting of every case by the doctor concerned is required by the guidelines, and non-reporting is a criminal offence, in fact, at least 3/4, perhaps even nearly 9 cases out of 10, are not reported in a famously law-abiding country. Outside the door are the relatives. What will they be telling the doctor about one's condition and one's wishes? What is it prudent to tell them about one's suffering, one's depression, one's wishes? Are they interpreting one's state of mind just as one would wish? Are their interests in line with one's own? Many people will find that their nearest and dearest are less and less near and less dear. Dutch doctors give the official anonymous statistical inquirers 2 main reasons why they almost always violate the guidelines and the criminal law by falsifying the death certificate and reporting that death was from natural causes. One reason they give is to avoid the fuss of legal investigation. The other, almost equally strong, is the desire to protect relatives from official inquiry. Ronald Dworkin's euthanasia book, Life's Dominion, tried to respond to such concerns. Even now, he said, doctors sometimes deliberately give dying patients large enough doses of pain-killing drugs to kill them. You see that in that sentence, him ignoring the question of their intent in doing so. He said this is a covert decision much more open to abuse than a scheme of voluntary euthanasia would be. Unquote. He neglected to note that whatever the scheme of voluntary euthanasia would be, the power and opportunity of doctors to administer lethal doses of painkillers would remain absolutely unfettered. But that same power and opportunity would, in the new order of things, be in the hands of a new breed of doctors, like Dworkin's projected new breed of lawyers and judges for Britain. Doctors directed to regard intentional killing as a therapeutic option, something good doctors quite often do in the new order. And now the covert decision to use lethal doses of painkillers would be a readily available end run around the law's paperwork requirements for legal voluntary euthanasia. An end run for those doctors who don't wish to use the alternative end run employed by Dutch doctors in 7 out of 8 cases of plain euthanasia: ignore the paperwork. Either way, avoid fuss. Don't involve the relatives in tiresome legal process. It's important to see what's at stake here. Suppose for a moment that there is a right to choose when to die, that is, to choose precisely to hasten one's death. Even more evidently, there is a right to choose not to be killed. The question is, the legal question is, which legal framework will take those rights most seriously? That's a question on which ordinary people have as good a grasp as anyone. In the new world of medical law and ethics, what conceivable legislative pronouncements, elegant preambles, government pamphlets, elaboration of hospital paperwork, physician reporting, official inquiries, and all that could remove or even appreciably diminish the patient's subjection to the pressure of the thought that my being killed is what my relatives expect of me and is in any case the decent thing to do, even though I utterly fear it and perhaps perceive it as the uttermost and ultimate indignity, an odious, devastating subjection to the needs and will of others. And likewise with the other sources of tyranny and indignity, the new power, opportunity, and ethic of doctors, and the real and novel power of the relatives. Dworkin, like almost all proponents of euthanasia, liked to insinuate that opposition to legalizing it is really based on religious faith commitments. This was and is a falsehood. The House of Lords Select Committee on Medical Ethics, commonly called the Walton Committee, which was set up in 1992 with 13 members, including only one Catholic, and a spread of liberal and secular opinion, medical, legal, or philosophical, representative of worldly secular British society, heard Dworkin, read his book, took a mountain of other evidence, visited Holland for discussions with the Dutch medical and legal authorities, and unanimously recommended against changing the law defining murder or assisted suicide. They judged unanimously that any change in the prohibition of intentional killing should be rejected because it would have such serious and widespread repercussions. They said, "We do not think it possible to set secure limits on voluntary euthanasia. It would not be possible to frame adequate safeguards against non-voluntary euthanasia if voluntary euthanasia were to be legalized," and so on, to the conclusion that any decriminalization of voluntary euthanasia would give rise to more and more grave problems than those it sought to address. The insinuation of Dworkin and many others that most of those who state such deeply informed judgments are disguising their real convictions is even more vividly refuted by the 1994 report of the New York State's Task Force on Life and the Law. The 24 members of the task force, set up in 1984 by the governor of New York State, were perhaps even more representative, secular, liberal, than the Walton Committee. Some of them thought and think suicide and euthanasia morally acceptable in conscience. But after considering a mass of evidence, including Ronald Dworkin's work, to which they carefully replied, with the aid of consultants, at least one of whom was and is strongly pro-euthanasia, they unanimously concluded that legalizing assisted suicide and euthanasia would pose profound risks to many patients, especially those who are poor, elderly, members of a minority group, or without access to good medical care. They went on that the clinical safeguards that have been proposed to prevent abuse and errors would not be realized in many cases. Unquote. These and their other reasons for unanimously recommending that there be no change in the law forbidding euthanasia and assistance in suicide, were carefully argued with full documentation over about 200 pages, and I strongly recommend the work to anyone interested. The secular, highly experienced and sophisticated members of the Walton Committee and the New York Task Force judged that if euthanasia were legalized at all, the right not to be killed would be catastrophically nullified for very many more people than the few whose supposed right to die is compromised by present law. You might ask why I've said so little about the realities of suffering, realities which tempt people to commit suicide or seek assistance in doing so or demand that doctors be legally authorized to kill them. One reason is that as the leading Dutch exponent and practitioner of euthanasia, Dr. Peter Admiral, said 30 years ago, pain is never a legitimate reason for euthanasia, because methods exist to relieve it, and in most cases to relieve it without adequately without adverse effect on the patient's normal functioning. And another reason is this. For every harrowing case you might depict or report which would fall within any legalization of euthanasia seriously defended in public debate today, there can be found dozens of cases quite comparably harrowing which fall on the other side of any such line. The hard cases, the real sufferings of real people, are not to be shuffled away in our deliberations about euthanasia. We need to ponder them, not least to ask ourselves what we should be doing about pain and depression and other relievable sources of misery. But we should also look for the line, any line seriously proposed, and ask the line drawers what sense they can make of distinguishing between the cases on each side of it in matters so important as autonomy, oppression, and existence itself. And in all these reflections, we should wish to remain uncorrupted by the terrible euthanasiast confusion between being in an undignified situation or condition and lacking human dignity. Mindful of the Nazi horrors, most English-speaking euthanasiasts have not yet turned their talent for rhetorically demeaning the dying or the comatose, vegetables as they call them and so forth, from that to doing the same for the mentally handicapped. But what reason of principle have they for this abstention? The deepest mistakes in Ronald Dworkin's approach to euthanasia are encapsulated in the fervor with which his book Life's Dominion suggests that nurses who care for the permanently comatose and who believe that they are doing it for a comatose person are in fact caring only for a vegetating body, with the ultimate insult, the conviction that they do it for him, unquote. He doesn't explain how it could be reasonable to think that a body supposed to be merely vegetative and no longer personal could be insulted by respectful and loving care, and he doesn't defend the incoherent person-body dualism involved in declaring the nurses erroneous in their belief that they are acting for a person, albeit a person in the extremities of illness and disability. Like the nurses and the whole tradition of respecting radical human equality, I think we should judge and act on the basis that persons keep their radical dignity until death, all the way through. The Walton Committee, immediately after setting out Dworkin's thesis, expressed the essential point. The prohibition, they say, I'm quoting, of intentional killing is the cornerstone of law and social relationships. It protects each one of us impartially, embodying the belief that all are equal, unquote. The committee had seen through the arguments from autonomy and dignity and pluralism. Unless doctors are to be permitted to kill anyone and everyone who makes a stable and competent request for death, they are going to have to proceed, the doctors, on a classification of lives as worth living or not worth living. Benign as its present authors and promoters doubtless generally are, such a classification would create in our society a new structure of radical inequality, with much resulting injustice and a gravely damaging impact on the common good. The sinister implications of such a structure tend to be readily discerned by members of vulnerable groups, as they were, we may think, by Aboriginal communities throughout the Northern Territory in 1996, a fact reported repeatedly to the Northern Territory Legislature by the special consultant commissioned, Mr. Chips McInulty, commissioned by the Northern Territory government to explain to those Indigenous communities throughout the Territory the meaning, limits, and benefits of the Territory's new euthanasia statute. What about the proposal to give the law's stamp of approval to same-sex sexual relationships of a certain kind by calling them and treating them as marriage? Well, here are four reasons why such a stamp of approval would be, and where it's already given, is a serious injustice and a long-term wound to the common good. First, stamping same-sex sex partnerships as marital gives the state's approval to, indeed colludes in, the shocking injustice of deliberately bringing into being, into existence, children with a view to their living in every case and by design without knowledge of or relationship with or the care of his or her father or alternatively his or her mother or perhaps either, and being instead attended to by a woman somehow imitating a father or by a man somehow imitating a mother, or else without even the pretense of having a mother or father, as the case may be. Now, to say this is not to say or imply that the adoption of children by homosexual couples is intrinsically evil in the sense that it should never be considered permissible, but it should for sure be reserved to the last resort, where the only alternative is abandonment or its near equivalents. But encouraging homosexual couples to deliberately bring children into existence for the purposes of such a defective form of parenting is unjust, and it is an immediate and unavoidable implication of everything savouring of same-sex marriage. I'm not arguing that the immorality and injustice of such a generation of fatherless or motherless children exceeds necessarily and in itself the immorality and injustice of casual sex generating fatherless children, a phenomenon that in its scale and dire consequences is characteristic of societies such as ours. But no one is out there in the public square arguing that the state should put its stamp of approval on casual sex and illegitimacy. But in fact, there is an overwhelmingly probable consequence of being raised by a same-sex sex partnership, marriage, as distinct from being raised by a single parent, namely that the child will have great difficulty in getting clear about the nature and the good of marriage, and so will tend to be severely obstructed from ever participating later in that basic human good. In this respect, there is an injustice in same-sex parenting that is absent in most cases from casual illegitimacy in single-sex rearing, for all the injustice of the latter. Nor does this first criticism of same-sex marriage discriminate against homosexual generation of unfathered or unmothered children. The reasonable position all round is that it is similarly immoral and unjust, and should, I think, be a criminal offence to arrange for generation of children by IVF for single men or women, whether or not they are involved in sexual relationship with anyone. This first criticism is the one that has aroused wide swathes of French public opinion to unprecedented protests against their parliament's legalization of same-sex marriage and a right to homosexual adoption. The protests rightly focus on what they call the right of the child to filiation, to a mother and a father, to be conceived with a prospect of a mother and a father. Second point, the stamp of state approval of same-sex marriage is also, in societies like ours, the stamp of disapproval of every kind of discrimination against such so-called marriages and against the actually anti-marital view of sex that these imitations or parodies of marriage embody. In other words, the other face of state stamping is the stamping out in the name of equality and non-harassment of all forms, except secret or deeply private forms, of heteronormativity, heterosexism, gender stereotyping, such as is implicit in such historic complementarity-laden terms as mother and father, husband and wife, maternal and paternal, manly and womanly, feminine and masculine, indeed, men and women. Parents who think legal same-sex marriage will not affect their own marriage will learn otherwise when their children come home from school aged 5 or 6, having been subjected to the first stages of a decade-long program of social conditioning and state stamping designed to gender mainstream them. That is, to impose on them the ideology according to which there is no naturally or intrinsically reasonable and normative sex-gender distinction as between male and female, or sex role as in father and mother, husband and wife. But instead, there's an ever more finely variegated spectrum of so-called gender identities to be discerned, or rather adopted, after agonies of pseudo-discernment and choice: lesbian, gay, straight, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer, questioning, and so on, all the way. After all, the stamp of state approval has inherently coercive implications. In all our polities, in all our societies, all homosexual couples are free right now to stage a wedding with all their friends, negotiate whatever recognition they like with employers, make contracts and wills entitling them to whatever mutual rights and privileges they please. What they lack in the absence of state approval is the right to coerce officials and other persons and their associations to approve and collaborate. Anyway, the bad effects on children of this deeply erroneous, coercively imposed politico-ethical ideology will be profound and in many cases prompt. Increases in suicide, anomie, listlessness and loneliness, and then later more failed marriages, more divorces and damaged children, as the true complementarity of the two real sexes is constantly downgraded, if not derided and defied. Meanwhile, and this is my third point, the same children will get the message: official and compulsory parity of esteem. That is, their parents' marital acts and their own, if they choose marriage, are to be regarded as no more expressive of a chaste and wholesome, honourable commitment to a lifelong friendship open to procreation and the upbringing of good sons and daughters than sodomy is. This ongoing hollowing out of marriage by devaluation of its central act, the conjugal or marital act, will be the ongoing inbuilt consequence of officially calling homosexual coupling marriage and marital. For the very first time, the state and its law would be ratifying and commending and holding out as good a form of sexual relationship and activity that is inherently anti-marital and therefore immoral. Proper marriage is a big deal, hard work. Its commitments to permanence and exclusivity are demanding, and they only make sense because of the institution's inherent link with having and raising children, procreation. But matching its parameters and values, it has an act, potentially not only very pleasurable or joyful, but also very meaningful. Because, whatever may have preceded this, it culminates in a procreative type of act, the giving and receiving of the seed of generation by way of each other's organ of generation, it enables the spouses, husband and wife, to express and actualize and experience their commitment to their marriage as a form of life inherently open to maternity and paternity, to, if Providence so disposes, their paternity and maternity as a completion of their friendship. But the marital act can only express actualize and enable them to experience their commitment and their marriage if they regard it as the sort of act that ought not to be done except as marital. Even a remote conditional willingness to be doing this sort of thing in a non-marital context or way prevents doing it being an uncorrupted, integral, expressing, actualizing, and experiencing of their marriage. Approving it for anyone is a conditional willingness, approving doing it in a non-marital way. In short, the real rational and natural intelligibility of marital intercourse is as expressing, instantiating, and enabling spouses to experience a commitment whose openness to procreation makes sense of its commitment to permanence and exclusiveness. Formerly, society taught the conclusion of that line of thought in many ways, including some inappropriately intrusive or overbroad criminal laws. Society taught, that sex is for marriage, as a distinguished justice of the United States Supreme Court, Justice Harlan, rightly put it in 1961, summing up the whole disposition attitude of American civilization and law. Then in subsequent decades, the law more or less gave up positively teaching that, but legal same-sex marriage would be saying for the very first time that sex is not for marriage, not about a man and a woman uniting in a way open to and appropriate for their becoming a child's father and mother. But marriage is not about that, and that marriage does not have an act that's just for marriage. The effects of such approval are bound to be enormous, medium and long term. Check back in 50 years, say, to get something like a measure of the effects wherever same-sex marriage is introduced. It's introduced always at the pressing of people who completely reject the morality of sex that, in line with Plato, Aristotle, Kant, and Christianity, I just gave you the briefest sketch of. So, fourth point, sex ethics matters to political life and political theory or philosophy because the wounding of marriages that results from spouses' approval of and even conditional openness to non-marital sex is not only an injustice to the other spouse and to the children impaired by consequently limping or failed marriages and to those later injured by those children, it also is contrary to the political common good in the additional and fundamental respect that it makes vanishingly unlikely the sustainability, long or even medium term, of the societies, the peoples, that have wounded their institution of marriage by encouraging and endorsing such false and harmful ideas. The wounding of marriage, so as to bring it into line with the contraceptive, abortifacient, feminist, and other marriage-dissolving demands and practices of many heterosexuals, has already put all our peoples on an ever-steepening path to wreckage, if not disappearance. No society or people can survive unless a large number of women in every cohort have three or more children. No society can survive in good shape, and sometimes societies need to be in good shape even to survive, unless these children are brought up with the permanent benefits of what evolution has made physiologically, psychosomatically, and psychologically complementary: maternity and paternity, profoundly different, irreplaceably beneficial parts of human makeup. Well, as I said at the beginning, there is one religious faith that teaches that a significant part of its own teaching, not the whole, but a very significant part, is fully accessible to everyone without the benefit of belief in the faith. Following the very clear teaching of the Rabbi Saul in his letter to the Christians in Rome around 57 AD, the central Christian community, the Catholic Church, has always called this part of the faith truths of natural reason, to distinguish this part from truths which it holds because it believes they have been disclosed by God in the events unfolding across the history of Israel and culminating in the words and deeds of Jesus of Nazareth, truths of revelation. To put it another way, it is a truth of revelation that some of the truths of revelation are also truths of natural reason. Among these truths that are both natural and revealed are truths such as that the universe is created by a transcendent creator out of nothing, that there is freedom of choice, both in the divine creator and in human persons of some maturity, and all the main truths of morality, including the moral truths about killing and about marriage and therefore about human sexual choices in general. To put it another way, as Thomas Aquinas does, when you are disputing with believers in a divine revelation, such as Jews, you can and should appeal to their own religious authorities, such as the books of the Old Testament. And when you are disputing with separated Christians, you can and should appeal also to the New Testament. But when you are disputing with unbelievers, you can and should appeal only to natural reason. The disputes Aquinas had in mind were precisely disputes about matters in the overlap between revelation and natural reason. The overlap between, for short, faith and reason. The overlap that includes creation and providence, free will and morality. So those of us who accept the Catholic Church's teaching because we believe it to be authorized by God, the Church, to hand on the information he has disclosed to it by the historic revelation that closed with the last of the apostles, can and should go into the public arena confident that on all moral matters relevant to the public sphere of life, there are sound arguments that are fully accessible to all people of goodwill, whatever their view of the question of God and of divine revelation. Of course, accepting these arguments on specific matters, such as the ethics of sex or of killing, might require certain people, a lot of people, perhaps, to change their thinking on a lot of matters in a way they'd find difficult and, in their present unreformed view of things, in their view, unnecessary. That's always the case with worldviews, and it doesn't alter the fact that if arguments are attentive to evidence and sound in their premises and valid in their reasoning, they are accessible to all. To say all this is not to say that revelation is of no use in the domain where it overlaps with natural reason. On the contrary, to say the least, it helps the believer to understand, say, to understand the realities of choice and intention more reliably. In the babel of voices that surrounds us all, the voice of revelation cuts through with a distinctive voice, which we learn from the experience of believing it, is reliably worth attending to and helpful in orienting our thoughts in ways that will turn out to be coherent with each other and with the real configuration of the universe and its history right across the board. That voice turns out, in other words, to be another voice of reason. I hope I've said enough about the moral, or rather immoral, characteristics of euthanasia and same-sex marriage to provide some matter for your rational reflections. Thank you.
That was Professor John Finnis with Opposing Death with Dignity and Same-Sex Marriage, Faith or Reason. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.